Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 1.
Almost 2,300 years after Plato died, a 20th century British philosopher, Alfred North Whitehead, paid him a brief but striking tribute.
The safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato.
It's tempting to judge this statement as a friendly exaggeration, but there are good reasons for taking it seriously, perhaps even literally. Plato and no other first asked and brought together in a systematic way the issues and questions that have defined the work of philosophy ever since. It's no overstatement, then, to say that philosophy came into existence with the thought and writing of Plato. In this sense, later philosophers, as Whitehead asserts, carry on the project that Plato first began. To be sure, the generations of philosophers since Plato haven't always agreed with the answers Plato proposed to his own questions. These disagreements continue up to the present day, and they have at times been bitter indeed. So, for example, another 20th century philosopher, Karl Popper, writes these harsh words about Plato's political philosophy.
Plato compromised his integrity with every step he took. He was forced to defend lying, political miracles, tabooistic superstition, the suppression of truth, and ultimately, brutal violence.
It may be hard to imagine that these words describe the same Plato Whitehead praised. Yet so it is. And in one respect, there's no contradiction here. Even Popper would agree that in the history of philosophy, Plato must first be reckoned with, today no less than in the past. As for any great writer, we can read Plato's writings now as if he were indeed our own contemporary. We'll find, in fact, that this is the best way of understanding what Plato was attempting to do in his own time. The tribute Whitehead paid to Plato needs to be taken seriously in a second sense as well. The image conveyed to us through Plato's life and work of what it means to be a philosopher. Plato says it's possible to live, to write, and to teach in a way that raises the questions of philosophy not as logical exercises or theoretical possibilities, but as issues that are alive, practical, and most important of all, unavoidable. For Plato, philosophy originates always in the immediate world of everyday life. It's there, in commonplace experience, that people first become aware of what Plato called the sense of wonder. This wonder marks the beginning of philosophical thinking. And in that beginning, philosophy is nothing if not practical. Like people in many generations before us, we often find ourselves driven to ask about the difference between justice and injustice, or between true knowledge and subjective opinions or beliefs. We ask about the line that separates good from evil, right from wrong. And most generally, we wonder for ourselves and for other people about how life ought to be lived, ought to be, what constitutes a full and complete life. These are the questions that set philosophy in motion, not only for philosophers, but for everyone. Just to be capable of reason, the natural capacity that for Plato distinguishes humans from other beings, is to encounter the problems of philosophy. Reason itself wants to know the answers to philosophy's questions. In this sense, philosophy is both natural and inevitable. It's something we can't not do. The only question is whether people will do it well or badly, deliberately or unconsciously, and much of what Plato says has to do with how these alternatives are determined. In its Greek origins, the word philosophy means love of wisdom. Philo, meaning love, Sophia, meaning wisdom. Plato believed the love of wisdom is set in motion whenever human reason encounters the events and objects of the world, as it constantly does. Plato's own life was tied in an unusual way to another life as well, that of Socrates, who was Plato's teacher. Socrates remained a central figure in Plato's thought and writings. Even aside from Plato's testimony, other evidence suggests that Socrates was a remarkable teacher. But in addition to his teaching influence, certain historical events of Socrates' life also impressed themselves urgently on Plato, as they did more generally on the city of Athens, where they both lived. The most important of these events in Socrates' life was its end, the fact and circumstances of his death. Socrates had spent his days as a gadfly, a self-appointed teacher. Walking the streets of Athens, he chose for himself the role of questioner. He asked questions of anyone he met. Questions that reflected his own sense of wonder about politics, about ethics, about education. Socrates himself describes this role.
It is as though Athens were a large, thoroughbred horse, which because of its great size is inclined to be lazy and needs the stimulation of some stinging fly. It seems to me that I have been attached to this city to perform the office of such a fly, and all day long I never cease to settle here, there, and everywhere, rousing, persuading, reproving.
Since Socrates lived in Athens, the questions he asked applied most immediately to that city-state. How it was governed, what the ethical ideals and practices of its citizens and their leaders were. These questions were often embarrassing and annoying. More often than not, the people he addressed couldn't answer him. And since these people sometimes had power, they eventually decided to take action against Socrates, to stop his questions, not by answering them, but by silencing the questioner. So Socrates, at the age of 70 in 399 B.C., was brought to trial on trumped-up charges of corruption and impiety. He was found guilty of the charges and then executed. Athens thus attacked the man who, for Plato and others of his students, had become its main symbol of integrity and wisdom. This attack marked a turning point in Plato's life, with lasting consequences for him. Through Plato's writings, Socrates' death has influenced the history of Western thought. Our acquaintance with Socrates' history has an unusual basis. Socrates had quite consciously decided not to write philosophy, but only to speak it. So Socrates left no written record of his thinking. For Socrates, philosophy had to be always alive, in motion, an active process like speaking itself. And this seemed to conflict with what he saw as the inert, inflexible character of written words. Obviously, since Plato did write, he disagreed with Socrates to some extent on the proper role of the philosopher. But even with this difference, Plato remained close in spirit to Socrates. Everything that Plato wrote, with the exception of a number of letters, took the form of dialogues, conversations which involved the exchange of ideas and sometimes arguments among a number of speakers. In these dialogues, the speaker who is mainly responsible for the direction in which the dialogues go and the conclusions they reach is Socrates. Like Socrates, Plato believes that the truths of philosophy are not the words that appear on a written page, but the spark that the words strike in the mind or soul, inside the person. So Plato writes in one of his letters,
"The principles of philosophy cannot be put in words like other studies. Acquaintance with them must come after a long period of instruction and of close companionship. Then, suddenly, like a blaze kindled by a leaping spark, knowledge is generated in the soul and sustains itself there."
Plato paid homage to his teacher and also wrote in a way that recreated Socrates' oral method. This process has come to be known as the Socratic method. Because Plato's dialogue presents Socrates as their main character, it's almost impossible to distinguish between Socrates' thought and Plato's. Although he's the author of the dialogues, Plato refers to himself in them only twice, and even then he doesn't speak in his own name. When we hear from Socrates in the dialogues, then, it's not clear whether we're listening to Socrates or to Plato, or even perhaps to someone else. We can't even be certain how literally the words are meant. It'd be interesting to have this information, but it doesn't make much difference in understanding the dialogues themselves. In the dialogues, singly and in relation to each other, the central questions of philosophy are formulated in a way that speaks to the audience, much as if the individual reader or listener were part of a conversation. And of course, the dialogues are conversations. The reader or listener is meant to participate in the dialogue, to find a place for himself there as a character, not just to read or listen to it. If answers to the questions of philosophy emerge in the dialogues, then they come from the reader or audience as much as from the author. Call this process Socratic, or call it, after its most immediate author, Platonic. In watching the process develop in Plato's dialogues, we gain a full and coherent view of the life and work of philosophy. It's a view that has never been surpassed, and it's rarely been equaled. Plato was born in Athens in 428 BC. Athens at the time was a city-state in Greek, a polis, with a total population of less than 200,000. But even that number includes a substantial slave population and a considerable number of aliens. The number of citizens was less than 50,000 and was thus small by modern standards. Athens' small size is even more notable considering its unusual achievements, especially in the 5th century BC. The first half of that century saw notable advances in the development of the arts, in sculpture, architecture, and in literature. This was also a period of innovative developments in legal institutions, political organization, and in the expansion of trade and commerce. By Plato's time, however, the creativity and sense of adventure in this unusual community had worn thin. The Peloponnesian War between Athens and its main rival, Sparta, had begun 3 years before Plato was born. It continued intermittently for almost 30 years, until 404 BC, when it ended with Athens' defeat. That defeat provoked a revolution against the democratic government of Athens. Soon, a counter-revolution restored a version of the earlier democracy. This restored democracy was responsible for the execution of Socrates, an event that later influenced Plato's opposition to the democratic form of government. Plato's family was prominent in Athens, and the sense of privilege with which he grew up drew him towards a role in public life. Plato speaks about this in an autobiographical letter.
I cherished, like many another youth, the hope of entering upon a political career as soon as I came of age.
But the social turmoil of the time, and then the execution of Socrates, convinced Plato that he was unlikely to realize his goal of a just and good society by pursuing a career in politics. Something more was required. Plato found this in the study of philosophy, in teaching, and in writing. Only with a basis of that sort, he surmised, would politics have a chance of success. Thus, again in his autobiographical letter, Plato describes his growing conviction that a just society was impossible unless certain difficult conditions were met.
Either those who rightly and genuinely follow philosophy must acquire political authority, or those who have political control must become real philosophers.
Plato was not optimistic about the chances for these alternatives. His own experience with practical politics gave him good reason for doubt. On two different occasions, he accepted invitations from the ruler of Syracuse on the island of Sicily to visit there. He was invited to offer advice on how philosophy might work in actually governing a state. The first visit ended with Plato's imprisonment by an impatient and jealous ruler. The second was followed by the overthrow of the government, which was then replaced by a harsh dictatorship. Plato could reasonably conclude from these mishaps that his energies would be better spent elsewhere, perhaps in teaching the group of students who'd begun to assemble around him. If it was futile, even dangerous, to apply philosophy directly to political institutions, philosophy could at least be embodied in students who might later shape those institutions as leaders. So Plato, returning to Athens from his first visit to Syracuse in about 385 BC, founded a school. This school later gave its name to many others. Plato called it the Academy, after the grove in which the school was located and which was dedicated to Academos, a Greek hero. Little is known about the actual organization of Plato's Academy, but it's reasonable to suppose that the ideals of education and the curriculum that Plato lays out in his writings were tried out in his own school. We might also guess that the method of instruction there resembled his dialogues, with a give and take, the question and response of the Socratic method. After Plato's death in 348 BC, the Academy survived under the direction of Plato's students, and then of their students. It continued to exist for almost 900 years until it was forced to close under a general policy of repression by the Emperor Justinian in 529 A.D. The main source of information that we have about both Plato and Socrates is located in Plato's dialogues themselves. As we've seen, there's an irony in this. Socrates had avoided writing, and Plato shared his reservations about the relation between writing and philosophy. In his dialogue entitled The Phaedrus, Plato offers a striking statement about that relation. We hear Socrates speaking with a quiet emphasis.
You know, Phaedrus, that's the strange thing about writing, which makes it analogous to painting. The painter's works stand before us as though they were alive. But if you question them, they maintain a majestic silence. It is the same with written words. They seem to talk to you as though they were intelligent, but if you ask them anything about what they say, they go on telling you just the same thing forever.
Socrates thus stresses that writing, as soon as it leaves its author's hands, becomes something quite different from the spoken word. Like painting, it gives the appearance of a physical object, but truth and knowledge occur in the mind, which is not material or physical at all. Only direct conversation, where the participants can examine the meaning of what's said, is capable of steering a course to knowledge. To be sure, Plato himself did write. The standard edition of Plato's work includes 28 dialogues. But as dialogues, these writings represent the spoken word. They retain its live quality, and they avoid assertions of doctrine or the bulky appearance of a philosophical system. On the other hand, the dialogue form of writing makes it difficult to determine exactly what philosophical views or theories are actually being proposed. It's not always clear even which views are being attacked or rejected. Nonetheless, certain themes recur in Plato's writings, and we can infer that Plato attaches special importance to them. These can be grouped under several distinct headings, but it's important always to keep in mind that Plato emphasizes the close connections among these and indeed among all philosophical topics. Plato's sometimes been called the great unifier because he emphasized similarities rather than differences, connections rather than divisions, the one rather than the many. So, for example, when Plato considers the problems of political theory, he also refers to the theory of knowledge and the philosophy of art. When he defines the questions of ethics, he shows them to depend on issues of psychology and metaphysics. Nonetheless, it is possible to draw some distinctions among Plato's subject areas, and we'll be focusing here on three different, although related, areas of Plato's thought. His ethical theory, his political philosophy, and finally a combination of his theory of knowledge and his metaphysics.
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.